Megan, Anna, and I are so excited to have a repeat sponsor who's supporting the Divergent Conversations podcast. Landmark College is the world's first accredited college designed exclusively for students who learn differently. Landmark, located in Putney, Vermont, which is one of my favorite states, offers courses in person and online, awarding associate and bachelor's degrees, and offering pre-college, gap year, and professional development programs for educators who work with neurodivergent students. With a student-to-faculty ratio of just 7-1, and the renowned Landmark College Institute for Research and Training, Landmark offers personalized and research-informed support for neurodivergent students that is not available at traditional colleges. Still enrolling for fall 2025. Learn more about this opportunity at landmark.edu. That's landmark.edu. Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening. All right, everyone. Welcome back to Diverging Conversations, where we are continuing our burnout series. And today we are talking about nervous system and nervous system regulation. Last week, we talked about our sensory systems. So one follows the other, and here we are.
Yeah, it's all connected.
It is all connected. So I will say that a lot of you listening probably are somewhat more familiar with the nervous system terminology at times than the sensory system and vice versa. I know for a lot of people really struggle with nervous system terminology as well. So we're following your workbook. So if you want to take the lead with this, go ahead.
So hot potato. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even as we like hit record, I'm like, oh, how much into it do I like go?
Yeah.
It is interesting because nervous system has kind of become a bit of a fad word, which it's cool in the sense that people are actually talking about it. Whereas I think even 5 years ago, if people were like nervous system regulation, people would be like, what?
Mm-hmm.
But it also sometimes with it becoming pop, there's also then like the risk of, I guess, oversimplification.
Right.
Nervous systems matter. And one thing that I like talking about and talk about a bit is the neurodivergent nervous system. I honestly can't remember what rabbit trail got me onto this, but I think I just got curious if there was any connection to like nervous system states and autism. I can't remember what I searched for, but I came across this research that looked at heart rate variability. So, okay, this is getting kind of nerdy. So not to be confused with heart rate. So our heart rate, how much it beats per minute, typically a lower heartbeat is associated with health. Not always, but you know, typically. Heart rate variability is different. It's how much variability is there between heartbeats. And a higher heart rate variability is more often associated with health because it's like a flexible nervous system. I think about it as clay that's been warmed up. So it's moldable. Whereas if there's less heart rate variability, it's like, okay, your heartbeat goes at this much. And it's more like an icicle. So it's like an incoming stressor or like a startle. Like I have a huge, massive, terrible startle response. I will literally like yelp if my dog barks and I'm in the focus.
Right.
And that's if my nervous system's more like an icicle, it can't like move as fast to adapt to incoming things or incoming stressors. Whereas if it was more like that warm clay, which I would say like my spouse's nervous system is more like that. It's like there's flexibility to adapt to incoming stressors and incoming signals and incoming sensory stuff. And so I can't remember how I found this research, but it was showing a connection between both ADHD and autism and lower heart rate variability. So I will sometimes talk about it as the like more rigid neurodivergent nervous system. For me, learning that helped me move through a lot of shame and unlock a lot more compassion because it names something that was part of my experience for a long time, which was I just react more strongly and intensely to stressors than the people around me. And it's not in my conscious control. Like, this is part of my wiring. And for me, that was really helpful to learn and understand.
Yeah, I'm sure that created a lot of self-compassion in those moments too, because when we are talking about like sensitivity and sensitive systems, I think so often we've been told how sensitive we are or how our reactions are so different than a lot of the world around us. So we can really internalize that, and it can become this, what is wrong with me mentality? Like, why am I the way that I am? And I think that creates, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just, like, at a character level, like, what's wrong with me at a character level versus, oh, like, my neurology is like, it's going to dip out of, it's going to flip into a stress state more easily, not because I'm a bad person, not because I'm moral failures, not because of character, but because my body's having a physiological reaction, like a sneeze. Right. Like, it's just my body being a body.
Exactly. But how many of us are going through life thinking, you know,
we're coding it as character failures.
Yeah. And when societal messaging is often that way, not even just for neurodivergent humans, just in general, like the way we react to things is like quantified and classified very specifically in a lot of arenas. So of course we default to like, this is a personal issue. This is a character flaw. And like you just said, it's my body being a body. Like I don't, we were just talking last week about how often did we think about our sensory systems prior to discovery? Not often. Sometimes, not often. How often was I thinking about my nervous system prior to understanding more about neurology? Really not often. I definitely wasn't walking through the world thinking, that's just my body being a body.
Yeah, or like when we get stressed, again, especially, you know, if we're autistic and there's been a routine disruption, and so we get stressed by it, and then we're in a stress state in our body. It's not like, oh, okay, I wasn't expecting this, and now my body's in like hyper arousal. It's, why am I so stressed about this? Like, get over it.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. And this can that messaging and that communication can also come from partners, friend groups, colleagues, family members, etc. So if there's a routine disruption and you are autistic and all of a sudden you are in that hyperarousal space and someone close to you is saying, what's the big deal? Like, why are you so stressed out right now? You internalize that.
And you also don't know. Like, I'd be like, well, I don't know why I'm so stressed.
Yeah. Which, again, can create even more of that, like, almost shame spiraling of like, why did that just bother me so much?
Yeah. Versus, and this is where, like, I understand how I think some people can hear this information and it feels like it's maybe pathologizing of our nervous system. And I think there's definitely ways it could be messaged that way. But I think this is why my experience of learning about and talking about the more rigid neurodivergent nervous system is ultimately empowering, because there's a reason that makes sense for why I have those reactions or why I can't be around, you know, six people and be okay. Like, it's not a moral failing. It's my nervous systeming.
Yep, exactly. So, t-shirt ideas all throughout this series. But I mean, that's so true. And your nervous system is there, your neurology is there to like help protect you, right? And to keep you safe and to tell you when there's threat. And if that feels like it's more rigid, the threat level is going to feel like it's more constant. There's more consistency to that. And it can be little things that really create pretty big disruptions as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that you brought in the language of threat, because that's exactly what the nervous system, one of the job is like, is this a signal of threat or is this a signal of safety? And some of the language that I really like is stuff like, how do we build present moment safety? Or how do we cultivate cues of safety that signal to our body you're safe? And I think that's part of when we learn about nervous system stuff, I think that's part of what we're able to do is then think through what are the threat responses that tell my nervous system you're not safe. Because the nervous system, it doesn't understand modern logic. It's still operating on a lot of like very old logic. And so it often takes intentional cues to say, hey, nervous system, actually, it's okay. You're safe right now. And when we know what our nervous system, first of all, is up to and that it's responding to threats, and then when we know what helps us to signal cues of safety to our nervous system, we're able to intervene in that process with a little bit more agency. Doesn't mean we're always going to be able to like get ourselves out of a stress state right away, right, but it is a way we can support ourselves either by the narratives we're telling ourselves or by sensory cues or by even breath work can be a way of sending signals of safety. And so sorting out what are the signals of safety that work for you that help your body register, you're actually not in danger right now. You're okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this gets really complex and really nuanced in terms of how to parse it apart. When we also add in people who have experienced significant trauma, which we know there's
many of us have
correlation, right, between our neurodivergent existence and some potential either complex PTSD, PTSD in general. And I think it's hard to sometimes separate, you know, what. Go ahead, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because it's a traumatized nervous system is a traumatized nervous system. And this is just really sobering statistics and hard to take in. But so PTSD is a lot more common for autistic folks. I think also for ADHD folks, but there's definitely research around autism. And partly what they found is that we tend to be exposed to more traumas, more victimization. And then on top of that, when we are exposed to traumas, we are more likely to develop PTSD in the aftermath, because not everyone who experiences a trauma will develop PTSD. Most people actually don't.
Yeah.
But I think part of that is that trauma is loading onto an already more sensitive nervous system. I think there's other pieces around it too that make us more predisposed to develop PTSD. But absolutely. And it's interesting. I get this question a lot when I give clinical training. It's like, well, is it trauma or is it autism or is it trauma or ADHD? And one thing I'll often say, if trauma is in the mix or ADHD, it's almost always both.
Right.
Not always, but it's, so it does get really complicated. And for many of us, we're not just living in a like neurodivergent nervous system. We're living in a traumatized neurodivergent nervous system that's intersecting with some complexities.
Yeah, very well said. And then let's add in living in a traumatized state of the world where your nervous system
is. Can we go back to monotropic manner?
So it's just one of those things where you're constant, you know, a lot of us are, you know, analyzing a lot behind the scenes. So I think for me, I'm always constantly asking, is it this? Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? Is it because of what's happening right now? Is it because of, you know, sensory sensitivity? Is it because of autism? Is it because of ADHD? Is it complex PTSD?
Mm-hmm.
Swirling mess of confusion sometimes.
Well, and it's like, can it be all the things?
And also at the end of the day, if it is all the things, does it really necessarily?
Yeah. So I do see this happen a lot where, And I think it makes sense because I think especially autistic minds, we like to pinpoint, but it's like, well, is it RSD or is it attachment or is it trauma or is it that? And it's sometimes that can be helpful. Sometimes applying a label, it's like, okay, this helps me wrap a narrative around it. It helps me know what's going to help. And then sometimes it feels like we're splitting hairs and then we're adding more stress by trying to reduce it to one thing. And this is actually why I think talking about nervous systems helpful is because it encapsulates all of these things, right? So if it's trauma, absolutely impacts the nervous system in such deep, deep ways. I think being neurodivergent, having sensory hypersensitivities impacts the nervous system. And so when we can have broader language like nervous system health and nervous system regulation, it captures all of those experiences, even attachment, like our attachment system impacts our nervous system.
Yeah.
So then we have frameworks where we don't have to be like, well, is it this or is it this or is it that? Because we have frameworks that can influence all of those things, if that makes, am I making sense?
Yeah, oh, for sure. And I think it's unbelievably helpful to have those frameworks, because otherwise it feels like it's really challenging to either define or identify or make sense of in sense of the word. So super helpful. So when we're talking about this, as it regards to what we're talking about in this collection or series, burnout, like it's going to be massively impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if we're in a chronically stressed nervous system, we're burning our nervous system out. Yeah, yeah, yep. Absolutely. Yeah. So that, like, that's all similar to getting to know, like, sensory profile. I feel like getting to know kind of our nervous system responses and states and, like, the things that do signal threat, the things that bring it back to safety. Right. So this all goes back to a lot of it is building that self-knowledge and self-insight around, like, just what the hell is happening in this body of mine?
Yep.
And so that's where... And this comes, I'm not a full proponent of polyvagal theory, but there's interventions that they use that I like. So right. Like the idea of nervous system mapping comes from the work of polyvagal theory. And that's one that I really like because it's about getting to know like what does, you know, the window of tolerance. So when I'm in that authentically engaged place, what does that feel like?
Right.
And for some of us, that's going to be, especially if it's both complex trauma and autism and ADHD, that might be really hard because it might be that we spend very little time there. But knowing like what that feels like, what helps us get there, for me, it's often monotropic focus is that if I'm struggling to name what the window of tolerance feels like, I think back to like the last time I was in monotropic mode and I'm like, okay, that's what it feels like.
Right.
And then knowing what hyperarousal feels like, that kind of fight flight amped up, the rubber band, or like for me, the chest, the pressure on the chest feeling.
Yeah.
And then knowing what hypoarousal feels like. And that's the fogging out, the kind of dissociation.
Right.
And then knowing what helps, like, so for me, knowing what triggers. So I have different triggers. It's interesting. Like a technology and shame and rejection, those are all triggers for hyperarousal for me. And like feeling confused, feeling like cognitively confused.
Yeah.
And then overwhelm and like a lot of sensory stuff and like harder, sad emotions. Those are all like triggers for hypoarousal for me.
Yeah. I would agree for the most part, that I experience it the same way. I think going back to what you just said a little earlier too, about like creating this library almost of like understanding your nervous system, understanding your sensory system. Going back to our vision of this monotropic manner, that could be in the library collection. That's a like that's an accessible book, ebook, or visual, you know, like picture book, textbook that you can access at all times. And it has these things easily identifiable for you so that you can kind of just flip through it when you're experiencing some of this stuff. Cause it's like having this resource guide almost for your system is so helpful, like to be able to identify so that you're not walking down the street or moving through the world and saying that just happened and that's a character flaw. That's because I reacted poorly. That was, you know, there's something wrong with me in that instance.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that's what kind of happens after discovery for a lot of us, yeah. Is we start building this like brain body manual. Yeah. Of like, okay, understanding it and then knowing what works for it.
Right.
And I think that is part of just like being okay in the world. But that's also, I think, part of burnout resilience is when we build that kind of resource of knowing our triggers and knowing what supports us. What are some of the things, have you found things that do support you when you're either in hyper arousal or hypo arousal and you're wanting to get into a back into a more authentically engaged place?
I will say that like playing soccer really used to help quite a bit. Mm-hmm. For a lot of reasons. And if I was in fight or flight, certainly very helpful. If I was in more of a dissociated state, it was helpful too. And it helped me just get back in my body. I think like any sort of physical activity like that, where I was exerting a lot of physical activity and it was really more intense, really always has helped me get back into my body. The struggle has been the chronic pain that I'm constantly in. It's hard to access that these days. So, but that was always something that really did help and come quite easily for most of my life.
So we kind of talked on chronic pain earlier in the season. I've often noticed that when people enter like a really steep downward spiral with mental health or addiction, when you trace it back, it often goes back to a chronic pain. And I think it's because exactly what you're in, and I can see the same pattern in myself. When you lose access, well, first of all, chronic pain is just like a hellish sensory experience. But then you also lose access to like the things that were making you okay. So like, for me too, going and doing intense weights with intense music, like playing basketball, doing HIIT training. These were the things. So when I was going through my grad program, like that's what I would do at lunch. And it was just, it got me through. And then when I lost access to that kind of intense movement, like it's not been pretty.
No. And that's a hard part of this, you know, is like losing the access and then trying to figure out like alternatives or creative workarounds. And, you know, and also you get everyone, the whole wellness world telling you basically, if you want to feel better or boost your mood, go do some exercise. And it's like, yeah, no shit. And also,
I wish I could
get off the couch. Or it hurts so bad to get up out of the bed that that is all I can do today. So, yeah, you know, that's been a frustration. But otherwise, you were mentioning you dropping into like monotropic mode in some of those scenarios. I would say, like, animals going back to this, just super regulating for me. And being in nature also very regulating for me. Really helpful. I so often forget to breathe in general that like focusing on breathing is not usually useful for me to help regulate my nervous system.
I hear that a lot from autistic people, which makes me sad because I experienced a lot. Like breath work has been really helpful for me with my anxiety, but it feels like it's 50-50. Like when I do breath work with autistic people, either it's like, I hate this. This is terrible. This is making it worse.
Yep.
Or especially when they understand the education behind it, it's like, oh, wow, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. I don't know if it's like interoceptive for me. Like I just forget to breathe. And I'm like, oh, why am I like all of a sudden like, and I'm sure that also impacts my voice because we were talking about my voice the other day on the other episode and how when I notice I'm in burnout and I'm more stressed and I'm more fatigued, my voice and the vocal fry increases, but I think a lot of it also comes with the fact that I'm often forgetting to breathe. And
Yeah. I bet it is interoceptive. I've heard other people talk about that. Yeah. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, I haven't been breathing for 3 minutes.
That doesn't seem healthy.
It's not.
You don't have dyspraxia, do you?
No.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now I'll get curious about it. I think my thought would have been dyspraxia and like kind of motor coordination and needing to consciously do that. Mm-hmm. But then, no, it does make sense. It would also be interoception.
Yeah.
You also have like low thirst and low like hunger and low pain.
Yeah.
So that would track. That's interesting.
But yeah, so I think trying to find these things that, just like we talked about with sensory, you know, making that guidebook for yourself, making that really having an understanding of your nervous system profile and the things that impact it. If I was to really, you know, we were using imagery before in the last episode. If I really thought about my nervous system overall, obviously I highly relate to your description of the like frozen/rigid response, but my Shih Tzu Hudson's nervous system is almost identical to mine. Like everything impacts him. Everything. Mm-hmm. And it's the littlest sound out on the porch. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a new thing that's happening in the house. It doesn't matter. A change in like food. I know that's more, but like, it's just like his nervous system mm-hmm. is on high alert all the time.
Mm-hmm. My dog is the same, which is why we call him the autistic one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like so much hypervigilance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think, so as much as it's also about honoring, I think honoring why our systems are this way. And yeah. again, especially if there's trauma, like, yeah, it's annoying to have a like sensitive nervous system, but also it's there because it's trying to protect us. And it's like for sure. scanning for threat, trying to protect. And also sometimes, because I think we have to honor it before we can even think about like shifting it or, because if it's, one of the things that I do talk about is if, when we start increasing awareness of nervous system, one of the traps I see people fall into is to start creating like secondary stress or evaluative thoughts about it. So for example, if you've kind of been unaware of nervous system stuff, and then you start being like, oh, I'm in like kind of hyper arousal, fight flight. This is bad. I need to like get down or I need to downregulate. That right. thought is actually creating like a secondary stress because we're evaluating this as like a bad thing.
Right.
And so first of all, honoring, I think, why our systems are this way, because they're trying to protect us, but then also getting into a more kind of compassionate, non-evaluative observational response to it of like, okay, the rubber band is here, or like that for me, it's like rocks on my chest. And then I'll maybe try and make sense of why it's there of like, well, okay, it makes sense you're feeling this way. And I'll maybe list a few reasons. Right. What would you like to do about that now, Megan Anna? Versus in a, you know, a couple of years ago, I think I'd feel that and I'd be like, this is bad. This is bad for my heart. This is bad for this. I need to get out of this. And then I'm actually creating like a secondary stress response to the fact I'm noticing I'm in a stress response. So it's not just about noticing. It's also about honoring why that's happening and then how we're noticing the response in our system.
Yeah, absolutely. It comes with work. You know, if you're sitting here and your immediate reaction is like, I can't access that. That's okay. Like it's absolutely okay that it can be really challenging to kind of evaluate that experience the way that Megan Anna just laid that out. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely a part of this. Like there, you know, we don't want to beat ourselves up more than we already are. And some of us have a really hard time trying to walk through those steps, you know, mentally. And I think that comes in waves, you know, like I think mm-hmm. when I'm more regulated, when I am more in like in that authentic engagement space, it's easier for me. And when I'm in mm-hmm. like burnout or, you know, things are feeling a lot more dysregulated, I'm like, fuck this. I can't do this mm-hmm. at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Like yeah. it's a hard thing to do when we don't have much bandwidth yeah. to then like not just notice it, to be gentle with it. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think we're so good. Many of our brains are so meta
mm-hmm.
that like we can have like secondary emotions or third emotions. So even the yeah. thing I just said about like when you're noticing the stress and you're evaluating it, like I could see some people having like a third response of noticing yeah. the stress and like, and we're so, our brains, I think, are uniquely good at snowballing emotions and stress. And I think the biggest thing is just whatever the experience is, to be able to like, even if it's for 2 seconds, tap into like, it makes sense I'm feeling this way.
Yeah, absolutely. You can, you know, co-regulation with your nervous systems too. And I'm just thinking about that as we're sitting here. And like prior to recording, I was mentioning like the rubber band feeling in my body and I don't feel that anymore. So co-regulating with people whose nervous systems and your energies can kind of support one another is super helpful.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that's huge for us. And it can be an animal. Like you talk about animals a lot. Like it can be an animal. It's interesting because a lot of the co-regulation nervous system comes from like parent child. Like that's often the where it's talked about. And the idea being like the parent often will kind of extend our nervous system to our kids who are dysregulated. So that's like the template I have in mind. But what I'm sitting here thinking on, before we started recording both episodes, we both were sharing how we're kind of in an emotionally hard space. So I wouldn't say either of us were like super like regulated, yet we've come together. And I think we have had a co-regulating experience, even though we were both starting in kind of a hard spot.
Yeah. Searching my brain right now to be like, is there anything else that feels not important, but I think you always call them sticky thoughts, but I don't have any thoughts.
I was like trying to read your face. I was like, is that deeply reflective? Is it, yeah. Well, I'll share. I think there's one other anchoring idea that I have found really helpful. And it's the idea of completing the stress cycle, which this idea originally comes from like a biochemist, but then it was like later developed by like trauma therapists, like Dr. Peter Levine. And then the Nagoski sisters, who they wrote I think a book that's really fantastic called Burnout. It's funny. They didn't know that they were autistic when they wrote it. And then they discovered that afterwards, but it's one of my favorite resources on burnout is their book. And they kind of popularize this idea because they talk about it a lot, the idea of completing the stress cycle. Okay. Trying to synthesize. So like in the wild, one thing we'll see is, let's say, you know, an antelope or a deer escapes a predator. So it gets that fight flight, which is, again, very protective. It's helping it run fast. Yep. And then when it gets to safety, you'll see it like shake and tremble. And what it's doing is it's releasing the excess stress from the body so that it can return to some sort of homeostasis.
Right.
And this is something that humans, especially in modern society, we tend to not be very good at completing the stress cycle, partly because we're always getting stressors that aren't signaling like the stressor is done and complete and you can like equilibrium. So the idea being we can still complete the stress cycle, even if the stressor actually isn't fully dealt with. This is what I really like about the Nagoski sisters is they distinguish. There's a difference between the stressor, the thing causing the stress, and the stress itself. And you can actually move the stress through your body, even if the stressor is still there. So like right now in our political climate, we are all living with a lot of stressors that aren't going away anytime soon. And we can have practices that complete the stress cycle. So like one of the recommendations in their book that I like, because it's just so concrete. It's like everyone should spend 20 minutes a day completing their stress cycle. And that can be like movement is one of the most effective ways to do that. But it could also be things like progressive muscle relaxation, which that's what I typically recommend to folks when movement's not accessible. So that's where you like you create tension starting in your toes all the way up and you do tense and release. And what it does is it releases the excess tension from your body. But also things like laughter or, you know, again, breath work or humming or chanting. There's a lot of different things that will help basically move the stress from our body or trembling. So that is an idea I like because it's very concrete of have I spent some time today essentially releasing the stress from my body and completing the stress cycle.
Yeah. Yep. It's a great way to do that. Wherever you are, you can do progressive muscle relaxation exercises. You can find scripts easily online available all over the place. I remember working as a therapist, walking people through progressive muscle relaxation scripts. And I was always like doing them simultaneously, but it just wasn't my style of therapy. So it was always fascinating that I was defaulted to that without really ever knowing why I was doing it. But I was also doing the exercises simultaneously. It was always very helpful.
I know. I always liked walking people through it because it was so relaxing because I can't teach something unless I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I did that more when I was in behavioral health. I would do that a lot because that kind of fits the behavioral health model.
Yeah.
But it is really effective. Mm-hmm. Or like I personally, and I actually can want to use it more. When I use it regularly, I'm like, oh, this feels so good.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of apps that will walk you through stuff like that too. And mm-hmm. can be very helpful. And
yeah.
And also
Dartmouth has like a 20-minute audio, which we can link here.
Yeah. That's a good idea. And it can help with interoceptive awareness too. Sometimes if I'm like, I'm not mm-hmm. feeling certain things within my body, like tensing and releasing is helpful for me to be like, oh, that's what that feels like. Oh, that's what that. Mm-hmm. Thinking of animals in the wild shaking off all the time. I think about this with our poor Shih Tzu, who is constantly having to shake off, like while he's on a walk in the neighborhood. I just watch him and I'm like, buddy, so sorry. Like constantly under threat, constantly feeling mm-hmm. overwhelmed, shake it real quick, look okay for a couple of seconds. Then that's just. Anyway, he's lying next to me, so that's what I'm thinking about it.
Or like the zoomies, like whenever our dog gets groomed, like he'll come back in and he'll have the zoomies, so he'll like run around. And then at some point it occurred to me like, oh, he's completing the stress cycle. How intuitive mm-hmm. of him.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, we all need our human version of the zoomies to complete the stress cycle.
We do.
And I think when we don't do that, that is when like it's easy. And like I had a season where like binge eating was part of, and it would be when I'd come home from a sensory stressful day. Right. And like, because I didn't have a way of doing the zoomies, that's where I'd go to things like binge eating or other like less helpful ways. And I think what my body was trying to do was complete the stress cycle. But because I didn't know what was happening, but also I didn't have like healthy ways of doing that, then I would go to unhealthy ways of almost like faux right. zoomies.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally makes sense. Okay. I think my brain is done.
Your brain is done. Okay. Let's tell people our goodbye
script.
Why don't
you wrap this one up today?
Oh, this will be fun.
It's so fun for me.
It's so fun when I do this. So what would be a PDA friendly way to do our outtake. Please do not go like download or subscribe. That would be terrible for us because then more people would find us and then we'd be perceived more by more people in the world. And it's really scary to be perceived right now. So please do not go like download or subscribe or listen to us. How's that, Patrick?
On Fridays. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Dr. Neff here. This season, we are clearly talking about autistic burnout, a topic that NeuroDivergent Insights has covered extensively. So if you would like more resources to supplement your learning, we've put together a page where we've curated all of our autistic burnout resources, freed and paid resources. We have lots of articles on autistic burnout. We have an upcoming free email course that's going to be released soon. We have workbooks on autistic burnout. So if you'd like to check out our resources, again, both free and paid, you can go to neurodivergentinsights.com/burnout-resources. It's linked below and in the show notes. I hope you don't need these resources, but if you do, they are there for you.